This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by Grain Seiko and the GPHG award-winning SLGH005. Part of Grain Seiko's heritage collection, the SLGH005 has a dial meant to invoke the graceful serenity of white birch. Please stay tuned for more information later in the show or visit grain-seiko.us.com for more.
Hey, it's me, James Stacy, and today I've asked a handful of my Hodinkee colleagues to jump on a mic and give us the inside scoop on some of their latest moves in the watch world. I predict this will be a varied and chatty show with some BTS via Danny and his recent hangout with Brooke Shields, Cole being fresh back from an artful time in Miami, and Logan offering some insight into the latest addition to his collection via a very under-the-radar choice from a brand with an incredible legacy in watchmaking. The clock is ticking, so let's go. Danny, Cole, Logan, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, James. Hey.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Happy to be here.
All right, so we've got a bunch to talk about. I put a bit of it in the intro, of course. Danny, I think we'll start with what I think is kind of an obvious highlight of our kind of December content schedule, and that's talking watches with a pretty big name. Who did you get to hang out with recently?
Are you talking about Brooke Shields, by any chance? Maybe?
That's the one, possibly. Yeah.
That was something. That was maybe the highlight of my entire 2021, potentially. That was very cool.
For sure. You know, I've done a couple of the talking watches with kind of sports level celebrities and, you know, people of very interesting kind of military backgrounds and stuff like that, but never with like a huge celebrity like Brooke Shields. You know, did you have to do security? Did you have to get past the bodyguards? Did you have to, put your phone in a special bag and not exist in the world? Or was that her kitchen? How did all this work out? Give us some of the kind of background.
You would be shocked at the level of how much security there was not to do this. I mean, we literally had the address to her home, which I won't be sharing here. It was very much her kitchen, very much her house in New York City. It's funny because there were whispers that we were going to be doing this. And I mean, we collectively as Hodinkee were thinking of doing this episode with her as far back as when we did 80s week. And there was no mention of who would be doing it, who would be hosting it. And I think some of the hosting duties sort of get parsed out based just on convenience of location. I happen to be in New York. Her house happens to be in New York. I think it just sort of worked out that way. But I was told about this one in a very casual conversation with Will Holloway, who's sort of the overseer of our video enterprise and creator of Talking Watches in so many ways. And he just kind of casually was like, yeah, the Brooke one is coming up and you'll be doing that. And I was like, the Brooke one, like Brooke Shields then. Okay, great. So let me just like mentally process that for a while. No, it was great. She has a beautiful townhouse in Manhattan that we went to, and we walked inside, and immediately I was surprised because her husband was in the living room and just sort of held up his wrist and was like, I have the same watch as you. And I wasn't wearing it was a Rolex Submariner. It was your grandfather's. And I was like, yeah. Oh my God, you read and you watch Hodinkee. That's amazing. It was like the first, like before we said hello, before we shook hands, it was like one of these like surreal moments. I was like, okay. All right. Like it actually kind of put me at ease for a second because I felt a little more comfortable immediately. But we were setting up the cameras and Will kind of ushers me into Brooke's kitchen and she's just standing there. And there are certain celebrities who have a very specific kind of star power where you just sort of feel it in the room. And that she's definitely one of them. So she was about to go shoot the Sunday Today show with Willie Geist and then come back and shoot Talking Watches with us. So she was sort of dressed for that.
As you do.
As one does, you know, just pack your day with media availability. So it gave us some time to set up. But no, I was just, you know, I introduced myself. It was pretty wild, at least to get things going.
Sure.
That was your first Talking Watches too, right?
It was my second Talking Watches, but first non-remote Talking Watches. My first one was Mitch Schwartz.
First in someone's kitchen, as it were.
First in someone's kitchen, first in Brooke Shields' house.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. And what did you think of the watches? Did you, you know, obviously we've watched it, and by now, if you haven't seen it, it'll be in the show notes, of course, or not that hard to find on the site. But how did the watches hit you, Danny? Did they make sense?
So I think it's important to contextualize this a little bit. And this is all, and I mean this in the most complimentary way possible. We sort of sat down and she was very honest with me. She was a little bit nervous to do the shoot, which I think had to do with her awareness of Hodinkee and not wanting to sort of not come across as knowledgeable as she thinks she should be about some of her watches. And I told her, like, this is not about watch knowledge as much as it's about your experience with the watches that you have. And so she has, what I found the most interesting about her collection was that it just was representative of her life. Because she's somebody that from 12 years old was modeling professionally. And so many of these watches are connected with these shoots, whether they were with fashion brands at the time like Bulgari or Piaget, they would give her watches in exchange for a photo shoot, an appearance, etc. These weren't things that she threw away. I mean, she kept them. And so they're kind of like these little micro totems of her career. And they're so representative of the times. I mean, they're very small watches. They're so very 80s looking. So many of them are gold. A lot of them have diamonds all over them. And then you have like the Rolex Datejust that she bought for herself with her mom, which she loved. And she loved it so much that after she bought it, she added diamonds to it later to kind of refresh a watch that she already had. You know, you can, I guess, either put a new strap on a watch or just put a bunch of diamonds on a watch. It's kind of the same thing, but
I sit up.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was this interesting progression of like, as she got more successful, the watches got more diamonds. And it was indicative of this kind of like Gordon Gekko sort of era of the 80s, you know. But as we move into sort of her adulthood, it's when we hit that incredible Rolex GMT Master.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
And for anyone, yeah, it was the best. And for anyone that doesn't know, we usually get a picture of a guest's collection of watches in advance so that we can sort of prepare ourselves for what we're going to go see. And usually it's on an iPhone. It's something, it's nothing like crazy. It's just to give you, to orient you in what you're going to get. And when I'm looking at this selection of watches that kind of run the gamut from, I don't know, 26 millimeters to 32 millimeters, 34 at max, and you have this, and they're all gold, and then you have this steel GMT Master with a faded bezel and patina dial. It was just, I needed to know what that was. And if anybody watched the video, you know what that was. It was a watch that she got in kind of the most insane circumstances possible, literally thrown at her in a moving taxi cab by an Italian count, so by royalty. And she, you know, he's since passed away, and it's a watch she probably wears more than any other. And she actually wore that to her Today Show interview that morning. So if anyone goes and watches that, you can do a little watch spotting.
It's interesting because the collection shows a really high level of taste. And despite the fact that some of, like you said, the early ones were gifts, and it just shows how good some of these brands were in their specific era. Like both of the Piagets, these little tiny Piagets, are both really gorgeous and kind of work today better than they would have 5 or 6 years ago. And you're not going to take anything away from the GMT, this incredible Panthère. Even the Bulgari, you know, makes a lot of sense for her wrist.
I love that watch.
Yeah, isn't that a cool thing?
Yes.
Some really neat stuff. Logan, and any of these hit you as kind of faves? I mean, the GMT's, it's so cool that it's almost like it has its own shadow in terms of coolness, but this is some pretty sweet watches. I mean, sometimes you see these and it shows a real mix of they got lucky and sometimes they weren't.
Yeah. I mean, the GMT is really, really sweet. And I actually have kind of a funny story about it because I've been hanging out with my parents a bit more recently. I've been spending some time down in Texas. And of course, you know, they want to see what's going on at Hodinkee. So when I told them Brooke Shields was on, you know, they got super stoked and they watched it. And now my mom is like super into the GMT Master. And I sent her.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And I think the Brooke Shields Talking Watches went up on a Tuesday. The next day, we had our vintage watch drop in the Hodinkee shop. And the hero image was a GMT Master that we had. I don't know the exact reference, but it was listed at 27K. And my mom, you know, she didn't look at the prices, but she was like, oh, you know, like that's that same watch. Like, did you guys plan that? And I'm like, no, they just, they're kind of everywhere, you know? And then I told her that it was $27,000 and she was like, whoa. which, you know, that's definitely kind of a sticker shock there. But I also, just going through the pictures again real quick, I really like this Pasha. And I kind of like the story about her father buys all his daughters a watch. How many siblings does she have? I'm curious.
I think she has three sisters, if I'm not mistaken. I might be wrong, but it's something in that range.
Yeah. Well, it's just like a really simple, sweet-looking Pasha. A lot of time I feel like they look very kind of convoluted. You know, they look like just a lot. But here, I mean, maybe it's just the photo. It looks really kind of sweet. And the 36912 dial, the slight guilloche kind of pattern, steel bezel. It's cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was a watch that struck me in person too, because I've kind of joined the others in this horological world of kind of railing against the Pasha a lot, just on principle. And it goes to show, because I don't get to see a lot of them in person often. And it is a cool watch. I mean, it has a cool functionality to it. It's interesting looking. And maybe that was bolstered by the fact that I was handling it after she told me the story. So I'm definitely not coming at it fully unjaded. But still, no, I totally agree with that, Logan.
One kind of Pasha variant that has been catching my eye recently is the C-Timer. Do you guys know that one?
I don't.
It's the super like funky chronograph. I'll send a link and we can put it in the show notes. But I think it's just kind of very emblematic of like Cartier's, they do kind of whatever they want. I mean, look at these kind of ovoid subdials.
Oh yeah, look at this thing.
It just works, you know?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I like that.
It just works.
Actually.
Very cool. Well, we'll dig up a couple examples and get those in the show notes. That's an interesting kind of derivation of that lineup for sure.
Yeah. And I'll go into it a bit more later, but just kind of digging deep into pre-owned recently, like you see a lot of these Cartiers from the early 2000s and whatnot that are really good values, you know, Pashas, C-Timers, things like that. And they all have very different styles. Like they're not just the same watch over and over and over again. I just like seeing that, you know, Cartier wasn't afraid to change things up all the time.
For sure. Cole, any of these stand out for you besides the GMT Master? The Air King's pretty sweet. That's a dial I'm not used to seeing on an Air King. I also don't think I've ever said the sentence. That Air King's pretty sweet.
There actually are some really sweet Air Kings. And I think that's the next one that people are going to notice. But for me, the one that stood out, Brooks Watches, was that gold date chest for the macro shots of the gold that develops that black sheen on it, on the lugs.
Oh yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like it's essentially just tarnished.
It is.
But mm-hmm. I was like, woof, that is a good looking watch with like the perfect level of patina. And I thought that was very cool. And also, I remember, James, you kind of went through a gold phase a year ago. I don't even know if you're out of it yet, but
I'm still in it.
All right. Good
for
man.
Sure.
Good man. I kind of am getting
most of those watches are out for service.
And I remember I think conceptually and intellectually you came around to exploring this area, which to me, to be honest, for a long time, it was stainless steel or bust or like some experimental metal or like tantalum from Omegas, sure. Chronos in the 70s, whatever. Gold to me was like a little gaudy, I will say, for me personally. Now, I think on my watch journey, quote unquote, I've come around to like think, ah, damn, these things are really, really nice. And especially when I saw Brooks, thinking the way that patina formed made me see the watch in a whole new light. And I was already pro gold. So I think that's the one that stood out to me where I just, when those, you know, macro shots, which again, Will, Davey, Gray, all those guys, they can capture those watches and it looked damn good.
Yeah. And I think there's something almost universal, even in gold for like a date chest. Like if you're going to go gold and that's the one exception that you've got in the mode, it makes sense. They look incredible on the bracelet. I think, you know, even despite the fact that maybe the fully iced out treatment isn't necessarily my taste, I do really like a full gold Panthère. It's just such a cool watch. They, you know, it's its own thing. It's almost like a watch made without any concern for anything other than Cartier's design language, and a really cool thing. And that diamond dial's pretty neat. I like that quite a bit.
The one thing I'll say is we don't see this so much in the pictures, but she really wears these watches hard, like hard. And I think part of that, it's, I mean, you can, it's hard to even like explain it properly, but these are not things that she babies or, and she cycles through them. She gives them their time on the wrist. And, you know, even the gold day date that she has with that wild kind of lavender effect to the dial, which, by the way, I think I have more experience dealing with like vintage, I don't know, 1970s era day dates, which this one was remarkably more heavy. I mean, you hold it and it's like holding a brick in your hand. It's crazy.
Also, something kind of interesting that just came to mind that I remember. So right around the time that you did that Talking Watches, Danny, I kind of knew you were doing it. Obviously, we're all remote here and sometimes we just don't have good communication. So we're all doing different things. So right around that day, like a day before, on that day, a day after, my buddy told me, oh, guess who I ran into in a coffee shop? And unbeknownst to him that we were working on a project with Brooke Shields, but he lives in the Village in New York and was getting coffee. And he said, I ran into Brooke Shields and I wasn't sure if I should talk to her or not. And I just did because we were both in line and she's like one of the coolest people ever. And I hadn't thought about Brooke Shields in, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. Like just where would we? Like when we were in high school, I remember there was a little bit of, you know, she bubbled back up. But so he said that. And then like a day or two later that day, you were like, oh yeah, we're doing Talking Watches with Brooke Shields.
That's crazy.
And I was like, wow, look at this. There's a glitch in the matrix.
Totally.
And so this is a testament, like even just a normal dude, she is a super nice, cool, chill woman. And like that comes across when you guys were talking to, like,
yeah,
good vibes, you know, good vibes in that Talking Watches.
Yeah, she's exactly as she appears to be on camera. And just this is completely unrelated, but kind of in my new journey to meet all of the models of the 80s and 90s. Not 2 weeks later, I was in San Francisco on a press trip and hung out briefly with Cindy Crawford. So just going to go ahead and like, wow, just say okay, that on Danny. Air, that did happen. And so I don't know who's next on the list, but I'm just going to try to pile these up, see how many more I can get.
I dig it.
We couldn't be more thrilled to have Grand Seiko supporting this episode of Hodinkee Radio with the new SLGH 005 from their Heritage Collection. Sporting a steel bracelet and a 40mm steel case, the SLGH 005 is a truly special watch that recently won the Men's Watch Prize at the 2021 Grand Prix de Horlogerie de Genève. Meant to invoke the look of the white birch that grow near the Grand Seiko studio where the watch is made, the SLGH 005's textured dial glints in whites, silvers, and light grays with an astonishing effect. Tucked beneath that dial, we find Grand Seiko's latest high-beat 9S A5 automatic movement, which ticks at 36,000 vibrations per hour while supporting 80 hours of power reserve and excellent daily accuracy. Plus, you can see it all through a gorgeous display case back. With a retail price of $9,100, the SLGH 005 is a handsome, subtle, and special watch that draws inspiration from Japan's own natural beauty and the fine craftsmanship inherent to all Grand Seiko timepieces. Check the show notes or visit grand-seiko.us.com for more details. And now, back to the show.
All right. Well, you know, speaking about chance encounters and standing in line for coffee, I assume, and meeting, you know, famous people and otherwise, Cole, you were recently at one of the calendar's kind of main social events. You want to tell us, because I've been to Miami before, not for Art Basel, which is what you were there for. The last time I was in Miami was for the Watches and Wonders, which has really turned out to be quite an enjoyable and weird event. Weird in a good way. Where did Art Basel fall on the kind of weird fun scale for you?
Good way to put it. Weird fun scale. So I have been one time before, but I will say, I mean, I'm not an Art Basel guy, like by nature, not to say I'm not purposely creating distance between myself and saying I'm not one of these guys, but I'm just, it's not in my nature to, you know, talk about NFTs, art, cryptocurrency, this kind of stuff. I'm like, all right, whatever. But, you know, as part of the job, we have to do things that push us out of our comfort zone. And I was actually there with Hublot. So there are two brands that really power Art Basel, watch brands at least. The intersection of Art Basel and watches exists in two spaces. One, Tag Heuer. Two, Hublot. So yeah, I was, you know, just, I had gone 2 years ago and, you know, met all the Hublot artist ambassadors. Then this year rolls around and, you know, they asked me to come again. I was thinking, I was unsure, but then said, you know what? Yes. Because it is actually awesome. I'm sure everyone here has experienced this, where you go into something thinking one thing, you come out and you're like, wow, I would have never done that otherwise, but that was cool. So
yeah, absolutely.
Did I get up to some trouble down there in Miami? Of course. There's parties all the time and all these like crazy things. Here's, you know, we're talking about celebrities and all that stuff. Also, I'm not super like aware of celebrities and all that stuff. So when it does happen, it's like, whoa, this is cool. Because they're very casual encounters. So Venus Williams made an appearance, the tennis player. Then Dustin Johnson, the golf player. Usain Bolt, who I was actually particularly like taken
That's
aback.
Great,
it was amazing.
That's
like,
great.
Whoa, damn, this is cool. Then all of the artists and some that we've written up. I mean, I think Danny, you may have done a Shepherd Fairey interview.
Yep.
Is that right?
That's right.
So he was there. You know, we connected 2 years ago. So it was good to see him again. Art Basel's a trip. It's definitely a trip. And we just put up a watch roundup. I wasn't taking those photos, but I definitely was witnessing the same kind of watch culture that exists down there. And I will say, going to watch meetups, you don't normally see like the Mad Paris or engraved stuff or all those aftermarket
right.
things. You see the press release, but you rarely see them out in the wild, right? I mean, how many of them have you actually seen?
None. Yeah.
Actually, yeah. So this is the first time for me. I saw a bunch of the modded aftermarket watches. Like that's the culture.
So before we get too deep into the NFTs, and obviously that we're going to package this show as an NFT, you can find it in your wallet whenever you look. Before we get too deep into that, I actually like, let's start with basic questions.
Sure.
It's anywhere in the city? It's in the art district? It's like, what is it? What are the confines? Do you buy a ticket and go to it? Or does it just happen around you?
Yeah.
What is it?
So it's... Yes, there is an actual
because I
art.
Feel that I'm not the only person who might have that question.
No, that's
I loved
totally
how you framed
question.
That question was framed very well, by the way.
It was, yeah.
It seems nebulous to me.
The mechanics of the situation are as such. At the convention center or a large, I think it is the convention center, is where the actual art installations are displayed. So you remember the banana on the wall from 2 years ago and stuff? That was there. And then this year, there were all sorts of pretty cool things. Then there are the ancillary component to that festival, which is really, I think, the spirit of Art Basel, is the parties that happen all around the city, hosted by brands, like everything, like fashion. So the interesting thing about the Hublot trip is that myself and then Adam Craniotis, who I'm sure everyone knows, and also
hey,
just to watch.
Shout out, Adam.
Yeah, Adam,
hey,
great
Adam.
Guy. And this guy, Sam, from England. We were three watch people on the trip with 10 fashion folks from the fashion industry. So they really like to explore the intersection of fashion and watches. It's not really a watch thing, Art Basel. It's more of a fashion and culture thing. So that was just interesting. So yeah, to answer your question, there are a bunch of parties all around the city every day and lunches. And like the big thing in Miami is like day clubs. Like people act like it's night when it's day. Drinking, techno music, you know, all, you know, around the clock. So that's what Art Basel is. But overall, I'm going to say Art Basel is a mood, James.
Okay. I don't like that answer. I was on board until that last part.
It's a state of mind,
also,
my friend.
Right. Well, like appreciating art, I guess.
Exactly.
Is this the sort of art that is approachable?
So yeah, I will say that's an interesting question, a hard one to answer. So for me, some stuff like the banana on the wall or whatever, that's just too far off in the weeds for me to even get. And a lot of it is. It just seemed like a circus or some sort of parody of real life. But every now and then, you look at something and say, oh, this is, I get it. Like, it just clicks. Hublot held a panel for their artist, Maxime Sangblue, who we've written about before.
Sure, of course. Yeah,
brilliant
yeah.
stuff. Like, and he kind of gave a talk and I was like, oh, yeah. This is, like, for all that weird nebulous stuff that I don't understand, this guy is doing something I can, you know, I can speak his language and understand what he's saying. So I would say in that there are moments of clarity amongst moments of chaos and where am I, you know?
Sure.
So that's that. That was Art Basel. It was a interesting place to do some watch spotting, I will say. And I guess the other thing too, that this underscores is that watches can really touch. Like, we obviously love the diving, the motorsport, the airplanes, all that stuff, right? We know those relationships, but there are a ton of other relationships out there that, you know, you have to be open to exploring. And once you are, yeah, it's kind of interesting. So, yeah, I mean, the Hublots, I, you know, have come around to really like them. I know, Logan, you might be a fan.
Yeah, yeah, some, you know, hit or miss. But the Seng Blues are pretty cool. I do have one question after being down in Art Basel. Did you see any kind of remains of the MCH group? Because it's the same people that put on Baselworld.
Good question. So, in fact, this is the mental gymnastics that you have to kind of do is this the same group? Like, in your mind, like, how does one company cater to such different demographics and put on a show? Like, the event planners that do Art Basel, there's no way that they could do Baselworld. And if they do, that's why it failed. I mean, because it does not translate. The answer is, I don't see any of, all I know about MCH Group is Baselworld, right? From going in 2019.
Right.
This doesn't feel like it has anything to do with that at all. It's just the name only. And like, that's a good question. You know, I should have really said, hey, can I talk to someone from MCH Group about, you know, business? I'm sure they would have liked to chat. I mean, I'm not totally up, and I know, Logan, you are. Is Baselworld gone totally? MCH, it has nothing to do with it anymore?
No, it got pushed back like 8-9 months, I think.
So it's happening.
Maybe next year.
Okay. All right.
I think it's the current context is maybe next year. A year from what would have been announced.
Yeah.
Okay.
Next
okay.
announcement year. Yeah.
Yeah, I really should have.
I'd be surprised if it doesn't come back in some setting, because they had a plan to kind of wrap it up and do a B2B thing. And we talked about this on the last episode that we recorded, this kind of idea that like once there's some freedom post pandemic or in the kind of final context of the pandemic, the last evolution, if you will, it'll be interesting to see if brands suddenly really want to go back to a traditional way of doing something, a traditional brand being traditional, which would be back to a big Swiss show, which could really be a benefit for this. And I think it's something that we'll have to definitely talk about once we see some of the chess pieces fall and move around next calendar year. But I'd be surprised if it's gone, especially if, like, it seems like Art Basel went well. Like, people went to it. I saw it all over Instagram.
Huge.
It seemed to kind of reflect and reverberate well beyond the watch world, like you said, Cole.
If they took the Art Basel formula and applied it to Baselworld, and kind of broke down that staid Swiss tradition and so forth, it would be like a global phenomenon, this Baselworld party. I think that's the secret. And if I had the chance to talk to someone from MCH, I would say, whatever you're doing here, do it there, because what you were doing wasn't working. And I think they have the secret sauce. And the secret sauce is these monster rager parties. That's what it is, I'm telling you.
I do wonder, you know, the thing is there's two things that Basel, and if you've never been to Basel, this is what I'm about to say is absolutely me kidding. But there's two things that Basel's missing: the beach and Joe Stonecrab. And Miami has both of those.
That's right.
And they both do their thing really well. The parties, you know, you got to party when it's time to party for work, for sure. But I'm glad, Cole, that you got down there and got to see an art, I guess, or many arts.
Arts of one all or the kinds. Other. Yeah.
So many arts.
It's a mood. Like I said, it's a lifestyle and a mood, James. This is what it is. So.
I'm just glad that we are seeing some sort of a return to these, like I said, these kind of events that cascade back into the watch space, because the whole show scene has been kind of fraught for the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, I spoke with Jack and Robin on the last episode about Dubai Watch Week, and it sounded very positive. People were there. They were excited to be there. Brands are there. You know, big name people from the brands, you know, they're business entities, but they're celebrities in our world to a certain extent, are strolling around and having conversations that they haven't been able to have for a couple of years. And to my mind, even though, you know, I couldn't be there, that seems highly positive to me. And that's how I see something like Art Basel. And the cool thing in my mind is if you took someone from the art world that wasn't into watches and dropped them in Basel World or Watches and Wonders, it would be a bewildering experience for the first couple of hours. So it doesn't surprise me that on the inference, to flip that, it's bewildering for us to step deeply into an art world.
Like someone from Vogue or something. So Hodinkee, how do you pronounce that? What does that mean? Like, well, we write about watches.
And for sure.
Basically, I always say, like, as deep as you can go in fashion, that's what we do in watches. And I explain it to mm-hmm. everyone. And the cool thing is, everyone's down with it. You know, they're like, oh, that's awesome. This is very cool. So let's see how that partnership or this touch point between these two worlds evolves, because I have a feeling, like you said, with these big shows, that'll only grow. I mean, as we see collabs with Oh, we can tie in the recent Tiffany Patek thing with LVMH nod.
Yeah, for sure.
So as we see all these things happening, my guess is the final takeaway from Art Basel, besides crypto, NFT, and all stuff that I don't know enough about to really talk about, is fashion, watches, and culture and watches will become a bigger presence in our world going forward.
Cool.
So that's that.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, keep that's what we're trying. And that aligns with what Nick and the kind of leadership are doing with Hodinkee these days, is trying to keep as the doors open as wide as possible to all the different facets of watch appreciation. So I think that's key. And then for anyone who's listening and you think I'm going to gloss over the Tiffany 5711, we're talking about it on the next episode. We want that one that Phillips is going to sell, and Logan's going to be watching that auction very closely in just a few days. And pay attention to the next episode. I will have it out as soon as I can personally edit and put it together, probably Monday afternoon-ish. But we will have some look at that. We just kind of wanted to see that number before we committed too much to digital tape or whatever this is. I do wanted to bring us back to watches, and I don't really feel like talking about the Patek any more than we have to. Logan, I like an interesting move in watch buying, and in my mind, the most interesting space in watch buying is watches that are maybe between 8 and 18 years old right now. I think it's the stuff that just came out and was hot before the Hodinkees and all of our colleagues kind of gave a space to the vintage stuff and the current stuff. And so you have this window of time that had some really incredible, cool watches, but didn't quite benefit from the heat of having websites and bloggers and YouTube and the rest behind it. And you recently picked what I believe to be a really interesting and cool watch, but one that few people talk about. You want to lead us up to bring us into your mind space here with this new purchase?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I think I should be upfront. You know, Danny, he's hanging out with Brooke Shields, Cole's flying down to Miami, and I'm hanging out with my watches. You know, that's where I'm at these days.
I'm recording not 3 feet from a really fun rabbit, so that's my zone.
Hey, what's the rabbit's name, James?
His name is Jasper. Yeah, he's a sweetie.
Jasper.
Mm, goodness.
He's quiet today. He must be sleepy. Usually he's throwing his stuff around.
Yeah, so it was kind of an unexpected purchase because, you know, my financials aren't in the best of shapes, but, you know, that's no thing. So the watch is a Blancpain Le Mans from the early 2000s, 38 millimeter diameter, 9 millimeter thickness, steel, 100 hour power reserve, the caliber 1150 inside. You know, it just really kind of hit a sweet spot for me in what I was looking for. And I really, really adore Blancpain as a brand. And, you know, I dig the 50 fathoms and everything, but I think kind of the history of the company post Beaver, post Piguet, or not post Piguet, but when Beaver and Piguet teamed up to kind of bring the brand back to life in the late 80s, you know, they were basically it. You know, I mean, Piguet came out with this movement, 100 hour power reserve, double mainspring, 3 millimeter tall automatic movement in 1988.
That's crazy.
It's also a 4 hertz movement, right?
No, it's 3. That's kind of my one.
Oh, it's 3. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I remember it was a big deal with the chronograph movement, and you'll remember this movement. I want to say it's the 1185, but it might not be the right number of digits. The 5 hertz that they eventually put in the
F385.
The chronograph F385. Okay. Yeah. That's a fascinating thing. And that's built on that. Those two, they must have informed each other because they both have the big power reserve and are relatively speaking quite thin, but obviously the chronograph one has the flyback movement and the rest on top of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that F385 is basically kind of, you know, a descendant of the chronograph caliber that they came out with in the late 80s, around the same time that they came out with the 1150. And just no one was really doing anything like Piguet at that point. And, you know, they were supplying to kind of everybody in the industry. They were supplying to Chopard, they were supplying to Vacheron, they were supplying to, I think, AP. You know, I think everyone wanted these Piguet movements. They were just kind of solid as a rock. They were thin. And this was when we hadn't really, you know, I mean, Panerai isn't even relevant at this point in time, you know, in the late 80s. So we're still seeing people kind of cling on to these around 35 millimeter sizes. And they came out with these movements that were just perfect for the time. And, you know, this movement design is 40 years old. And I'll share a picture with you so you can put it in the show notes. But it's just a beautiful movement. I mean, Blancpain's finishing is, you know, very subtle. It's all about kind of like fine lines and graining. They do this thing on the 1150. And I don't know, maybe Jack would be able to help with this, but like, I don't know if there's a technical reason for it, but there's kind of like this open gap. There's like this kind of margin between the kind of central gear train and one of the bridges. And it's just like this really kind of interesting, delicate shape. And I don't know, it just, it feels different. And that's kind of why I'm attracted to Blancpain. And, you know, I still love the brand, but we don't see as much kind of in this vein from them today. I mean, the movements are still fantastic. And I really like the Air Command, but, you know, you're not seeing a 38 millimeter kind of all around piece. It's all about Villeray or 50 Fathoms or Bathyscaphe, and that's great.
You know, and the format of the Le Mans in my mind is kind of a very elegant take on a sporty dress watch. Like it's even more like it has a dressy side and another side. And in my mind, there's some competition. And I know that they did several different versions. I believe there was a chronograph, there was a big date. Were they all based on that same movement, loosely speaking, or not necessarily?
You know, I think the architecture is similar, but, you know, I mean, back in the 90s, they would just throw like all sorts of different complications on that same kind of base automatic architecture. I mean, they would turn it into manual wind. Walto Detz has a really kind of cool piece on the manual wind version of the 1150. If you can kind of trudge through the remains of time zone to find it. But it's a really kind of, I don't know, there was just such an appreciation for what the brand was doing technically. And today, you know, it feels all about diving, diving, diving. And again, amazing story. I'm a huge fan of the 50 Fathoms. I'd love to own one. But I guess that was a thing for me. Like I never thought that I would own a Blancpain. I never thought I'd be able to afford one. And so like the fact that I have one now, like makes me smile, you know, like this is the most expensive watch I've purchased for myself. And, you know, I have a Black Bay 58. I have the Oris Caliber 400 Hodinkee edition that came out a couple months ago. And now I have this kind of Blancpain. And I feel, you know, yeah, I feel good about that. I mean, I have probably 30 other kind of affordables and stuff like that, which, you know, I've definitely fallen down that rabbit hole of always trying to buy something new instead of saving up. But I think this is going to be around for the long haul. I haven't been able to take it off so far. And one thing that's funny that I realized with the new Oris, of course, our Oris was 38 millimeter, 120 hour power reserve. This is 38 millimeter, 100 hour power reserve. You know, maybe I'll start a collection of 38 millimeter watches with power reserves in triple digits. I don't know what else might be out there, but I'm sure there's some other things.
I was actually just going to say, you're kind of becoming, I mean, we've obviously seen you develop as a writer too, like the topics you choose to cover and now your taste in collecting, you're becoming the movement guy. I mean, you like obscure, interesting movements. I remember your 1815 Rattrapant piece.
Yeah, that's a killer story.
And I think you kind of, and to hear you talk about it, I'm seeing, yeah, you just kind of come into your own and really grab that space. So this is cool to hear. And I think the Blancpain is a testament into moving in that direction, you know?
Take it, Logan. Cool, it's better than being the Space Jam guy. Trust me. Take it.
You know, Logan, I'm interested. Were there other watches from this era? Like, were there competition for this watch in your mind? Or did this opportunity kind of come up and you felt something for this watch specifically? Because I can't even place what this would have been leveled against in a cross section of buying at the time, like in the early 2000s.
No, it is kind of a weird place because it's definitely dressier than like an Explorer or something like that.
JLC Master Control or that kind of stuff. Like not maybe all the way up to the QP, but that would be in there too, right?
Yeah, that's a good one. And that has a pretty comparable movement. I think the 99.8 or something like that, which is a cool thing. And I don't know. So no, I wasn't actively looking to spend thousands of dollars on a luxury watch, but I saw it and it just kind of was like, you know, I kind of bonded with the idea of it. And I was like, it's my watch, you know? And so I kind of went with it and been riding that high ever since. And it feels good. Like I don't know. I wasn't sure how I'd feel about it when I got in person. Like I knew that I'd like it. And my first kind of reaction was, it's really small. Generally, I like 41 millimeter dive watches, stuff like that. Even the Oris 38 millimeter with the bezel, it wears a bit bigger. You know, this has kind of the stepped polished bezel. So it very much kind of sinks down onto your wrist. And I have it on
very thin too. Yeah,
9 millimeter, but I have it on Black Shell Cordovan and it just like feels like a dream.
And it takes you can fit a traditional strap. You don't have to worry about a curved lug end or anything like that.
So the distance between the lug holes and the lower case edge is pretty tight. I'm able to get Shell Cordovan in there. I've been able to get the Arcedona strap from the Hood and Key shop. But I tried like one of the Ute NATOs. I wasn't able to get that in there, which was kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to keep experimenting and I'm stoked.
Well, I guess if we end up seeing spring bar bending tools added to the shop, we know why. Because I've done that before to fit a NATO into a especially on some of the Rolex stuff. A bent bar helps quite a bit.
One other thing I wanted to bring up is, you know, it has the Blancpain on the case band and the engraving. And I have to say, like, I think because it is such a thin watch, the way it sits, like, I don't even notice it. Like, when you have kind of a 45 millimeter 50 fathoms with that tall sapphire crystal bezel, you know, it's a little more apparent. But here, you know, it feels more kind of part of the charm than like a distraction. But, you know, I'm probably just drinking the Kool-Aid. So
I actually kind of agree, because I was just looking at that. I'm looking at one of the ultra slim big dates, which I think would be a very similar case. And not only does the engraving, it takes up most of the side of the case and it's spread out nicely. But on some of the bigger dive watches, it's on like a placard, almost like a shield. And then the engraving seems to be on that. And I think it's better just right into the case edge. I think this makes more sense. I would believe if you say you don't notice it. Also, because the case is kind of scalloped. It dishes down into your wrist. So you'd almost only notice it if you took it off. I think it's a good thing. Lume is decent, I assume. There's, you know, decent size markers and such.
Yeah, Super Luminova, which I'm curious. So I should have been, I got this from Hood & Key pre-owned and they had sent it to Blancpain for kind of a complete factory service before they listed it, before I know it existed. And, you know, it's a 20-year-old watch. So they, you know, put new hands on there. They, you know, did a bunch of stuff to it and I'm not complaining. You know, it feels brand new to me and that's kind of what feels good about it. But the Lume is awesome. I assume since they dated it to early 2000s, it is Super Luminova. There's some that are a bit older that had tritium that you can see kind of faded. And I guess one thing that I am really curious about, I haven't cracked open the case back yet, is whether or not mine has a silicon hairspring, because at that era, it would still be kind of the traditional Nivarox. But when it goes in for service, I know it's an option to trade up to a silicon. So that'll be a surprise. And I'm kind of thinking, I don't know, I need to see how I feel, but I really like the case back. It just has the kind of case number on it and is open. You know, I couldn't engrave it, but I was almost thinking I might try to put a sapphire crystal case back on it just to see the kind of movement and action. I'm inquiring about the bracelet.
Ooh, a bracelet would be kind of nice on a nice thin watch like that, yeah. And have you found yourself eyeing other versions? I've got a whole screen of them up here. And Cole, I could really see you getting into one of the Pilot-y chronographs.
Yeah.
Now that you say that, like, yeah, this is also, I don't know. Let me take a look at it. I might be joining the club, Logan. Let's see. And riding your coattails on the research that you've done on this one.
Those chronos are the same. They're a little thicker, but they're also 38 millimeter. So it's a great size for a chronograph. And there's a lot of different variations, like you said, James. If the big date was in front of me and it was the same price, I would have gone for the big date because I think big dates are super cool.
But yeah, you know, it's fun looking at all these different ones, and it's not just the chronograph or the big date or grand date. I think those are really cool, and obviously the Le Mans. We also saw the Aqualung, which was I guess an even sportier, maybe slightly less dressy version. Almost has an Explorer vibe, the Aqualung, and then I'm Googling through this and I'm seeing some pretty wild stuff. There's a flyback perpetual chrono.
I'm vibing on a triple date moon phase over here. It's that's a kind of a killer with a pointer date.
Yeah, but I think it's fun to talk about these. It feels like Cole and I spend a lot of time talking about 90s JDM cars, some of which honestly weren't even good cars when they came out. They've become good because they're weird and loosely affordable compared to what's happened in the rest of the market.
Yeah.
And with these, I feel like these were probably not the kind of watch you saw a lot in the early 2000s. I don't want to lean on what I said at the start of this, but I do feel there is this sweet spot. And Blancpain, IWC, there's a lot of these brands that had really, really awesome lineups just before the internet really picked up steam, long before Instagram made, you know, 4 or 5 brands all that most people seem to know about or want to buy.
Are you saying the internet ruined watches, James? Is that basically what you're saying?
Well, I think that would be the snake eating its own tail, you know, given that we're on a podcast from a large watch media outlet. I think the internet changed watches. And I think that from, you know, Logan had mentioned Panerai not being as big a thing in the early 2000s. And that's true. Panerai's kind of general resurgence was really tied with the growth of watch internet. And they became kind of the first big magnet for that heat. And now we have, obviously, we've seen it happen to basically every watch, every brand at some level, especially if you talk, you know, 1953 to about 1969, and then 2010 onwards. Those seem to be the two big generations of what's been covered for obvious reasons. The vintage has been very hot for a long time, and then new watches that were covered by the internet kind of started around that time. And I think there is this really interesting generation. You know, the Aquatimer stuff really comes to the forefront of my mind. I think Omega had a really incredible lineup in the 2000s with some very interesting Speedmasters and some really incredible Seamaster stuff like the GMTs and the Apnea stuff and the Regatta timers and all these things. And I think this slots in so nicely. And Logan, I think the watch really speaks to a really high level of taste. It's a very subtle, really elegant watch that is super nerdy without being too showy about it. It's not the Tourbillon version, which they did make. But kudos, man. I think it's a cool piece.
Good on you, mate.
Congratulations, man.
Appreciate that. You brought up Omega in the early 2000s, and a story that I really want to do is kind of going inside the designers at Omega at that time. I mean, that's when they really kind of started their 21st century wave. They came out with the Aquaterra and Planet Ocean in succession, and those are two home runs that have been in continuous production for almost 20 years, gone through multiple generations. I mean, those are awesome watches.
And they're watches you see in the wild. You see people looking at them. You know, you see them in ads. Like, yeah, longstanding, successful lines for sure.
Yeah. And I think the commercial success of pieces like that helped Omega kind of gear up to kind of go inward and do all the kind of technical development, start experimenting with materials. You know, we saw the Dark Side of the Moon in 2012, all the Meta stuff, 2014 or so.
And their progression through coaxial. You know, with the 2500 ABCD, and then suddenly you've got 8,000 series movements that's industrializing something that a lot of brands couldn't have figured out. And I agree. I don't think we would have seen it if they hadn't had such strength in the late 90s and the early 2000s to kind of carry themselves forward as, you know, one of the major players in the widest kind of sense of a watch brand.
Yeah, they got a series of Railmasters that look just like the Ranchero, which I think is super sweet. I think another really cool piece, which actually dates to like the 90s era, is the kind of early like second generation Breguet Marine pieces. I mean, like that's a really interesting design that kind of really felt authentic to the brand, but also really sporty. And it's been through so many changes over the years. And the current generation is, you know, I think a tough sell. Like, I love the brand. And I think the Marine is such a cool watch. But Breguet in the kind of post-InvestCorp early Swatch years was doing some like wild,
for sure,
wild shit.
I got two for you, and then I'll bow out. First one, the Tissot C-Star from that generation.
I had a 600 and a 1000.
They were so good.
For sure. Bad crowns, if I remember correctly. Both of mine went in for repair on the crowns.
The Baume & Mercier K-Planned, but the good one. There is one that's
with
awesome.
The yellowy dial?
Yeah, that yellow kind of pearly mother of pearl
super
or something.
Super cool watch, for sure.
Two good ones from that era that I would be interested in checking out one day. You've started a trend, Logan. We're going to go back and kind of look at all these watches. So.
That was kind of the Omega Dynamic thing that I did a couple, I don't know, a month or so ago. It's a similar era, similar kind of, I don't know. The watch, people were still giving it flack for whatever reason, but
forget about
them. I think that's an amazingly cool piece that I think it is coming around. I think it has sort of come around. I mean, there's a weird social media, YouTube undercurrent of watch collectors that have latched on to some of these more esoteric in the middle of vintage and modern, neo-vintage, whatever you want to call it. And I think so much of it has to do with, and I mean this nicely, that they're attainable, they're affordable, they're out there, they're different. And
makes a big difference. Yeah.
And you're betting a little bit on future collectability or value increase or whatever, but or you just love the watch, but they're out there. And that's why I love this stuff.
Price doesn't equal charm. Never has, never will.
There's still deals out there. People like to act like there's no deals. You just have to kind of figure out what you like, you know, and go from there.
Pre-Richemont IWC.
Mm. Yeah.
Like think the GST Tasty. Stuff.
GST. I was going to bring up the GST.
I'm a big fan for sure.
What does GST stand for? It stands for like something...
Gold, steel, titanium.
Yeah, that's it.
If I remember correctly, I could have that wrong. I don't think I do.
No,
I've ever seen a GST in gold, to be fair. Maybe two-tone, but definitely seen some in steel and some in titanium.
I like the white dial one, Rautrepont, with the red seconds.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, do you know the one I'm talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's some great stuff out there, and I think that's a fun, like actionable place to end. You don't have to buy a Rolex to be in this. You don't have to buy a Tiffany Patek to be in this. You can be in this and show the same level of taste and consideration and the rest of it for considerably less amount of money, but no less nerd credit, no less appreciation at a meetup if you get to go to a Red Bar or something in the future. I think there's a whole world of watches that are, you know, maybe 1988 to 2005. That really, really show some cool stuff, some high-end watchmaking and some interesting stuff that you're not going to see at the same level on Instagram or at a table at a watch event or something like that. And I think Logan's Le Mans is a kind of a great example of some of the charm that's available out there if you step just outside the normal four or five sort of walls that are typically put up on the idea of being a budding watch collector or a successful watch collector.
Probably. Four walls in that case. Break out of the box.
Could be a Pentagon.
And I might add just as like an extra bookend to that is there's like a whole era prior to the sort of sexy sport watches that came out of the mid 1950s as well that are more of the dressy variety. We're talking about the advent of the Seamaster 300 and the Submariners and all that, but right before that you have this whole array of 34 millimeter, you know, watches that still have not, that are totally attainable and affordable and out there and have all manner of, you know, good movements inside and mostly from Omega, but a ton of brands.
Best entry level vintage watch will always and forever be a 1950s Omega Seamaster dress piece.
Boom. Mic drop. Totally. I agree.
I don't disagree that the price is up on those, but not up insane compared to where they were a few years ago. There's like a ton of different versions. So there's a lot you can dig in and learn. The Omega forums are incredible resources and are totally readable and can help you through that. And they can still be serviced. A competent watchmaker can keep one of those things running and they look great. They don't feel too old or too small or anything. I think that's a great tip, Logan, for sure.
And I think I should qualify that and say from like a major label brand because we're going to get a bunch of people coming in with all the glycines in the world and stuff like that.
Hey, there's no perfect, but that's a fantastic suggestion. And yeah, if you want to have a brand that you can connect with a current legacy, I think it's Omega is a great option where you can have the vintage charm, but still kind of look at it and feel like you're part of something that's still kind of big and special today. Well, cool, guys. This has been, as always, really fun. And Danny, super fun to hear about your hangout in Brooke Shields' kitchen. Cole, I'm so glad that you got a chance to go to Miami and check out an art. I assume you picked up some crypto and some NFTs and the rest. And so any moment you'll be on the moon and we won't have you as a colleague anymore. And you know what? That's okay.
That's the plan.
We'll hang out on the yacht and drive the Lambo. And finally, Logan, super fun having you on to share the new Le Mans. Congrats on that one. Always fun to see the way that each of us kind of think about the next watch or the way that it reflects on our other ones and these little avenues in the watch world that are kind of not undiscovered, but just don't get the same heat that other areas do. So guys, it's been a treat. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, sir.
All right. If you're enjoying the show, please tell a friend. Let us know in the comments if we missed something. That's usually what I'm pretty good at. So go for it. And if you're enjoying the show, we'll have another episode in just a few days' time. So we'll chat to you then. Thanks a ton for listening.